Hello, and welcome to the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. I'm glad you're here. Today's episode is part of the SLP Spotlight series, where I talk with SLPs in a variety of SLP positions and settings, doing things that we knew SLPs did, but also working in areas that we've never thought or heard of SLPs working in. It is amazing the opportunities these SLPs have taken and where their careers have gone. This is storytelling time. Welcome to this edition of the Missing Link for SLPs. I am here with Courtney Overton. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I am good. How are you?
I'm good. It's end of the summer, so back in school gear.
Excellent. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Tell us who you are and why you're here.
So my name's Courtney Overton. I'm a speech language pathologist. I have a business called Speech of Cake, and it's located in Alexandria, Virginia, on the other side of the border in Maryland. I work part-time as a researcher at the University of Maryland, and we are studying the African-American English dialect. And on the weekends, I guess you could say, I am a doctoral student at Indiana University. So I'm getting my EDD in literacy, culture, and language, and it is an online program. So it's been very seamless with COVID, and I've been able to continue with my studies and analyzing data that I collected a few years ago. So well on track. I'm in the fourth year of the program now.
And it's a four-year program?
It is a five-year program, so I've got a few more classes this school year, and then next school year will be dissertation writing.
And soon it will be Dr. Overton.
Yes.
Very, very nice. One of the faculty here just got her doctorate, and she's loving all of the doctor this, doctor that. So an accomplishment, especially through COVID.
I know. It's exciting. Hopefully, I'll be walking across the stage for we'll say, I think May 2022, that's the dream.
Good. Tell us how you got into the field of speech pathology, and if you knew if you wanted to get a PhD, EDD, go all the way right away?
So when I was a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh, I really wanted to be a dentist. And all throughout high school, that was my intention. And then once I got to school, and there were a lot of classes that I really hated, like science classes, chemistry, biology, I knew that that was not going to last. But I really didn't know what was going to be the next move. So with Pitt, they have a lot of funds that you can go on different trips and go to shows. So I went on something called a reflection retreat in the mountains at a ski resort. And it was a lot of meditation and thinking about yourself and what qualities that you really like about yourself and how that could transfer into a career. And I took one of those career aptitude tests on the trip as well. And speech language pathology came up, and I had never heard of it. So I quickly did some Googles, and I also found some SLPs that I could observe, because it was very important to me to understand what the day-to-day was like. And I did that in high school, too. I observed a few dentists when I was a senior in high school. And it really had a major impact on me, because it does involve the mouth, and I like that. And I like that the fact that has a medical piece, but it also has an education piece. And I was able to still be a teacher and also influence children with my knowledge in a different way. But I never thought that I would. I mean, I looked into the clinical doctorate. The University of Pittsburgh has a clinical doctorate, and I thought about it. But then once I graduated, I said, I really can't go to school anymore. And I did take a year off, and I worked as an assistant teacher after I got my bachelor's. And then I went to Emerson College for my master's. And at that point, I mean, the master's program at Emerson was very difficult. So I really, really, really said, this is it. And then I started kind of feeling stagnant in the schools. So that's when I decided to start the business. So I graduated in 2013 from the master's program, and then I started my business in 2016 because I really wanted to make some of my own rules and see some of the clients that I really wanted to see. And I've always had a passion for literacy, and I knew that that was not my lane. There's a reading specialist, there's a special education teacher, there's a general education teacher, and lots of different interventionists in the schools. So I knew that I wasn't really going to be able to use a lot of the literacy skills that I had acquired in the school system. So it really all just kept piling and piling, and then it just said, now's the time. So I applied to Virginia Tech, and that really was not a great fit for me because most of the people in that EDD program are interested in being superintendents, which traditionally that's what the EDD program is for. And then I found a program at Indiana, which is for literacy, culture, and language, and that was definitely the better fit for my interests.
So you looked around and found a program that did meet your interests and then applied for that?
Yes, and my budget, because I have student loan debt from Emerson. Thank God my parents paid for undergrad, but I do have debt from the master's program, and I did not want to take out additional loans for the doctorate. So it was important to me also to find a program that was affordable, that I would be able to pay for on my own with those month-to-month payments.
That is a question I see out on the chat groups like Reddit and Facebook with the students. They're going into a grad program and they're like, well, how important is it that I can afford it? I mean, do I want to buy the best program I can, or something within that costs less? I mean, does it get me any further ahead if I pay a lot of money? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on what your plans are for after graduation. So if you really want to be in academia and you want to be at a tier one school, which is very heavily research focused, it's important to get a PhD from another tier one school that has that reputation for a research intensive university. But if you're interested in being a different type of faculty member, like a clinical supervisor or a clinical instructor, it seems like the EDD and the SLPD would be the best route for that type of degree. And in terms of the clinical doctorate versus the research doctorate, it just depends on what, like I said, what your intentions are for after graduation. So I've always wanted to continue to grow my business and also work in academia, mentoring students and teaching them how to be better clinicians. And that's what the EDD is about, it's a practitioner degree. So learning how to be a better teacher, how to be a better clinician. And that I want to continue to share that information with other SLPs to be.
And your speech of cake business has a philanthropy side to it.
Right. So after speech of cake, well, we started speech of cake as a summer program only, but then in summer 2017, we got lots of calls of people that were interested in continuing for one-on-one sessions. So we did, and we went into students' homes, and we found that we were having a lot of puzzles and games rolling around in our back seats. Then we got an office space, and we did feel a lot better and more secure. And then that's when we started to, expanded. And one of the things that we changed that year, in addition to getting an office space, was adding the philanthropic component. So we speak at DC area high schools, predominantly with high schools that have a high population of Black and Brown students. Since the field of speech language pathology, there are about 91.7, just looked it up this morning, 91.7 of SLPs are white, mm-hmm. and 22% of children K through 12 are at least bilingual. So that, I mean, those two things don't always go together. But I say all that to say that we do need more diversity in the field, culturally and linguistically. So it's important to me to speak to high school students and let them know about the field. And I also encourage them to continue to email me and keep in contact. So there's the public speaking piece and sharing what the field is, but there is also the mentorship piece, because I really want them to continue to contact me and ask me questions. There was a girl that I spoke with at the, before COVID, I spoke at a public charter school in DC in February. And one of the women, young women there, she graduated in June, and she contacted me and she said, "I got a full scholarship to school, but they don't have speech. What do I do?" So I like when students contact me and ask me those types of questions. I've also had a few college students contact me, and we've met. So the mentorship piece, the first meeting, we just meet and I have them come to my office and I have a PowerPoint presentation that explains what an SLP is and how you become an SLP. And then the second meeting, I have them observe a session so that they can see what it looks like. And then the third meeting, I typically take them out to dinner at a local restaurant and we make some long-term and short-term goals for their career path. So I have done that, you know, both with high school students and college students. I've also written letters of recommendation, things like that. So the philanthropic component has really blossomed and I'm very excited about it. So hopefully we can still do it this year virtually. So that's the plan, to expand to Maryland and Virginia, since we're all, you know, right next to each other.
Right. What has been one of your biggest challenges since all of our changes with COVID?
Well, in March, when I thought it was just going to be like a quick 2 weeks of teletherapy, I remember that Friday hearing about the state of emergency announcement, and all day Saturday, all day Sunday, I got on Facebook, got on Instagram, and I attended every free webinar, every Facebook Live, every Instagram Live, so I could learn how to be a teletherapist, because I had never done that before. It was so scary. And at the time, I had about 15 clients that I was meeting with. And, you know, half of them did not want to do teletherapy because they said, you know, our child is going to be on the computer all day for school, and we really don't want to continue with speech and language therapy. So that had a major impact on my business. And so I ended up getting a contract with Richmond Public Schools, which, you know, my license is in Virginia, but Richmond is 3 hours away. But with teletherapy, I was still able to work with these students and continue to receive income, even though I ended up losing half of my clients. And some did return after a few weeks, and some returned after a few months. But it was very scary at that time. I know that a lot of business owners have been impacted. So we applied for different grants, as well as the EIDL loan and the PPP loan, to make sure that we were able to stay afloat.
Sounds like you had a good contingency plan in place.
Yes, I did. It was, like I said, very scary, but we quickly transformed the business within about a week or so and added, we used Simple Practice for our electronic health record system. And so we added their teletherapy platform, and it was pretty seamless in the sense that everything was all embedded. So the client, the parent would receive an email 24 hours in advance for their appointment reminder. And then 10 minutes before their appointment, they receive a link. So it's a different link every time to make sure that we are adhering to all of those cybersecurity risks and making sure that we don't have hackers in our sessions. And I really like Simple Practice because I'm able to also do billing through them, and clients can enroll in auto pay. And so that makes the billing process and the scheduling process very simple.
Tell us a little bit more about your research.
So at the University of Maryland, I work with Dr. Nan Bernstein Ratner. She is the principal investigator on the project, and it is a 5-year project. It's federally funded by NIH. We started in fall of 2018, so we're in the third year of the grant now. And in the beginning, that first year, we were analyzing language samples that were already available online, and we partner with Carnegie Mellon University. And so there are a group of computer programmers there, as well as linguists there, that have developed a program called CLAN, which stands for Computer Assisted Language Analysis. And so you can type in a you can type a transcript, and then CLAN will analyze it and produce lots of different information. You know, lots of SLPs use MLU. It does that, but it also gives you different types of grammatical as well as morphological information to analyze different utterances. So we've been doing pretty good, around 1,000 files that we've analyzed each year, each school year. And this year we're taking a shift, and we're trying to obtain new language samples. It has been tricky with COVID because a lot of researchers around the country are not meeting with research participants, but hopefully we can still do everything online. And so, you know, we really want to have at least 50 utterances per language sample, and we want to continue to analyze the samples so that we can actually norm African American English between for students between the ages of 2 and 6. So we want to make sure that SLPs are not over or under diagnosing students that speak this particular dialect. So the over diagnosis would say, you know, this kid, I don't really understand what he's saying because he speaks a different dialect and I don't understand the dialect. And so, yeah, you should take him on your caseload to make sure that you can fix his language. But he doesn't need that because he speaks a different dialect. And then the underdiagnosis would be the SLP that says, oh yeah, he just speaks AAE, it's fine, we don't really need to look into it any further. But then at the same time, this student has errors that are not supposed to be in mainstream American English or African American English. And so that's really the crux of the research project, so that we can create these norms for African American English to better help clinicians accurately diagnose students that speak African American English.
Sounds like very important, needed research that you're doing.
It's really, really nice to work with Dr. Ratner, and we have a few consultants around the country that are, I would say, experts in AAE. So it's been really nice to learn from them, and also working with the students at the University of Maryland. They're very organized, and they're always asking great questions. You know, sometimes I don't know the answer to the questions, and I like that because, you know, I'm teaching, but I also want to learn myself. So I always tell the students, you know, I don't know, but I'll get back to you on that. Or, you know, let's research this together type of thing. So that's really exciting.
So that cues up a question in my mind, since I teach advanced voice disorders, is, I know you're focusing on language, but I would be somewhere down the road, somebody I hope does a project on just voice patterns, prosody patterns, AAE.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. And with Pratt, depending on how you say it, you can analyze different voice patterns with Klan and Pratt, which is might be a good fit for some of your students if they're interested in doing that type of research.
We have Pratt here at the university.
Oh, good.
Here we go. There we go. That's how a research project is born, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would be very interested in that. What has been the best thing that's happened to you since you've started your, either your research or your philanthropic work?
So my research for my doctoral program is a little different. It is in, my dissertation topic is text selection for and by students with disabilities, because I was working at a middle school and I noticed that they were able to go to the library every month for a monthly book report. And I noticed that a lot of students were not choosing books with students with disabilities, especially the students that had disabilities, whether that be, you know, autism, dyslexia, ADHD. They're frequently choosing books that are interesting to them in terms of, you know, I like Messi, he's a cool soccer player, so I want to read about that. Or I'm really into dinosaurs, so I want to read about that. So I was trying to figure out, are they not choosing these books because they don't know that they have a disability, and so there's no point, you know, I don't need to see myself reflected in this book because I'm not in this book because I don't know that I have a learning disability? Or is it because is it the lack of resources, where there aren't books in the library that have students with disabilities in them? Or three, is it because the teachers are just allowing them to choose anything and not encouraging them to choose these types of books? So I don't know the answer to that question yet. So that's what I'm trying to figure out now. And with all of the, everything that's going on right now with Black Lives Matter, and lots of people are talking about having inclusive libraries. Mm-hmm. It's been really cool to see that start to erupt in terms of having children of color represented in classroom libraries. And it's amazing. And so I'm still figuring out what that looks like, what disability lit looks like, and how that affects children in middle school, and how it has an impact on the young adult literature field.
What disability looks like? That's an interesting question I don't think I've ever thought of.
Yeah, one of the things that I wrote in my last paper is that when I look at the young adult literature, you know, like the ones that receive the Newbery Award, like the top 10 books of the year, there may be a character, a protagonist that has a disability, but a lot of times they have a physical disability. They may have broken their leg and they're in a wheelchair for 6 months, or they may have cerebral palsy and they walk with a walker, but you don't frequently hear about or see the invisible disability like dyslexia, which is so common in the sense that 1 in 5 children have dyslexia, but it is invisible. So it's really interesting to me. Maybe these authors don't know that statistic. Maybe the children don't know that they have dyslexia. Maybe their parents have never told them. So I'm really interested to continue to dive into that issue.
It'll be fun to watch and follow as you learn more about, as you learn more answers to your questions.
It's going to be really interesting, especially with COVID. I've interviewed general and special education teachers, and I want to continue to interview them and see how they have adapted their classroom libraries virtually.
So, final question. What is the best piece of advice anybody has ever given you that you would pass on?
When I was at Pitt and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, lots of people said, you know, you think you want to be an SLP, but you really don't know what that is and what that looks like. So yes, you should definitely observe and see if that's what you like, but just don't observe one person in one setting. Make sure that you see what speech-language pathology looks like in different settings. And that really stuck with me, especially once I got to Emerson and we had the autonomy to be able to decide kind of what area we were interested in terms of our placements. So I made sure that I saw lots of different things and worked with lots of different clients. So I worked in an elementary school, a middle school. I was at a skilled nursing facility. I was in an outpatient facility. I was in a private practice. So I really took that and ran because I wanted to make sure that I really understood the field on a number of levels in different settings. So I think that's really important as a student to make sure that you're not one-sided and one-track minded, and make sure that you're gaining as much experience, diverse experience as you can.
It's one of the reasons this podcast was born. I had students who, because of COVID, were not able to get out and do what they wanted to do and see what they wanted to see. And I created these episodes where I interviewed people just like you, who were thought leaders and research instigators, initiators, and really were moving forward and able to represent so many things that a speech pathologist can do in the world.
Yeah, so, it's really amazing. And that's, I think, one of the coolest things in our profession. Like me, you know, I'm at the university level, but I'm also in private practice and I was in the schools and, you know, I really love the schools, but then I said, I want to do something different. And then I did. And I can continue to do that throughout my career and make it interesting and make sure that I continue to soak up all the knowledge that I can, because I'll never stop learning.
And that's the best attitude to have. Thank you for your time today, Courtney. We've appreciated you spending it with us.
Thank you very much.
I hope today's conversation has created some aha moments for you and motivated you to become a better SLP, continuing to connect some of those missing links between what you know and how to use that knowledge. Thank you for downloading the Missing Link for SLP's podcast. And if you enjoyed the show, I'd love you to subscribe, rate it, and leave a short review. Also, please share an episode with a friend. Together, we can raise awareness and help more SLPs find and connect those missing links and get the information needed to help them feel confident in their patient care every step of the way. Follow me on Instagram and join the Fresh SLP community on Facebook. Show notes are always available, so come learn more at freshslp.com. Let's make those connections. You got this.